The following is for your ears only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
The campaign Congress connection. It's all politics. We look at the tactics and strategies in both arenas.
NATO's Afghan summit is seen by an ex-Marine major whose can-do crew won their little part of the Iraq war.
Faith and philanthropy. A talk with the new head of the Nathan Cummings Foundation, one of whose grants has helped keep this program alive.
Fallout from the NRC resignation. Have charges about the management style of America's top nuclear regulator overshadowed lessons from the Fukushima disaster?
Singing the 60s. If you really experienced them, you shouldn't be able to remember. So a young cabaret performer reminds us of the decade's swinging soundtrack.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only for the week of May 27th and Memorial Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
This kind of stuff is nauseating to me on both sides. It's nauseating to the American public. Enough is enough. Stop attacking private equity. Stop attacking Jeremiah Wright. This stuff has got to stop.
Here we go again. Last year, just the threat of not lifting the debt ceiling caused us to our credit rating to be lowered.
Why do we want to wait and rush this through at the end of the year after the election?
Newark Mayor Cory Booker on NBC's Meet the Press last weekend raised the eyebrows of more than a few fellow Democrats with his nausea over President Obama's heavy stress on collateral damage from Mitt Romney's years at the private equity firm Bain Capital. And some Republicans were as disgusted as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on ABC's This Week after Speaker John Boehner's renewed threat of another potentially paralyzing debt ceiling standoff, also on Meet the Press.
It's all politics, of course. To make the connections and analyze the prospects on Capitol Hill and the campaign trail, for your ears only, we're joined again by TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a Newsweek DailyBeast.com contributor. Welcome back to our weekend program.
Glad to be with you.
What was the Washington reaction to Mayor Booker's reaction to the Obama argument that success in private equity has little relevance to running a country, since the president can't sell off or shut down the poorest, oldest, and weakest?
Well, I think the Washington Beltway buzz was that Mayor Booker had undermined the White House message, and the White House did come back pretty hard on him, and he then clarified his statement. The point is that the president's campaign wants to underscore the fact that Romney has this kind of economic halo because he's thought to have been successful in business, but are the skills that he demonstrated as the founder and leader of a private equity firm the same kind of skills that you would use in the White House? And I think Romney opened the door to the attacks by claiming that he had created 100,000 jobs and that his tenure at Bain Capital made him a job creator. So I think this is a debate that will continue throughout the campaign, and it's probably going to be enlarged to the role of capitalism in our society. And, you know, should it be as unbridled as Governor Romney says it should be? Should there be the kind of regulation that the president is advocating? And I think they're going to fight this out.
Is Romney significantly foreclosed from citing his record as governor of Massachusetts? Because that would immediately lead to his health insurance reform that's so similar to Obamacare.
Right. And his record as a job creator as governor of Massachusetts wasn't that great. He was number 47 out of 50, although his supporters will come back and say that's because unemployment was already so low in Massachusetts that there weren't any more jobs that needed to be created. But the fact that his signature achievement as governor was a universal health care bill, which is very much, actually was the model for what the president has done. He can't really advocate that during the primaries, and the primaries aren't even quite done yet. But you would think this would be an asset for him in the fall election, and we'll see how it plays out. And I think whatever the Supreme Court decides in June will certainly influence the way both these candidates for president handle their campaign when it comes to health care.
How much traction do you see for Romney raising education as, quote, the civil rights issue of our era, given the limited role of federal funds in education costs, only about 10%?
I think that really boomerangs because it doesn't really give him inroads into the black community, which is, I think, he was hoping that by saying this is a civil rights issue that he would gain momentum among minorities. And I think they're very suspicious of anything that has to do with vouchers. And it's an issue that just seems to come out of nowhere. He hasn't talked about it at all during the campaign. So it looks kind of opportunistic. And President Obama has done some things on education that has actually won praise from Republicans. So I'm not sure where the fight is on education. This seems to me a bit like a side issue, although certainly revamping American education going forward in the technological age should be a big challenge for whoever is president.
Beyond the sway of issues, especially on independents, you wrote recently about the key demographics of election 2012, starting with so-called millennials. Remind us how that group is defined and how its share of the electorate has grown.
Well, millennials are 18 to 29, and I think 4 million of them come into the electorate like every month. It's a huge generation, and President Obama wins with them by a 2-to-1 margin over Mitt Romney. But how many of them will actually come out and vote? And I think that's, you know, 4 years ago, young people really rallied around candidate Obama. It was exciting. It was a real phenomenon. And now they've seen him govern, and he hasn't been able to do everything he promised, and now they're not quite so interested. So the challenge is for the president to really energize that portion of the electorate. And for the Republicans is to find issues that can appeal to them. Romney has come around on student loans and wanting to keep interest rates low, I think, which he might not have done if there wasn't an election looming.
But you say he can afford to win over fewer of them percentage-wise because there are so many in total. Give us some comparable numbers for the growing ranks of Latino voters.
Well, Latino voters are the fastest-growing block of voters in the country, and here again, President Obama wins by a substantial margin. And George W. Bush actually did well with Hispanics. The attitude towards Hispanics and immigration in Texas is very different there, more positive than it is in other parts of the country. And I believe Bush won 44% of Hispanic vote in 2000 or 2004. Anyway, he did well. And Romney scores pitifully low among these voters. And he took a lot of really far-right positions during the primaries that are going to make it difficult for him to change the tenor and the tone of the way he talks to this constituency. But if Republicans don't figure out a way to appeal to Hispanics, they're going to be destined to be a minority party themselves, because you have to appeal to the new America, and the growing number of Hispanics are part of that new America.
To what degree do you see this year's presidential and congressional races affected by threats of a new debt ceiling budget battle, presumably favored by Tea Party forces to which John Boehner has been so responsive in the past? Does it energize the GOP base more than it turns off moderates, independents, swing voters?
There's going to be a lot of gamesmanship on raising the debt ceiling, on extending the Bush tax cuts, and I don't believe any of that is going to be decided until after the election, and both sides are going to use it to energize their base of voters. John Boehner has had a lot of trouble corralling the new Tea Party, really, they're almost independents within his caucus. And he's worried about getting them reelected, and they're going to go back home, and their voters are going to say to them, well, what exactly have you accomplished? Did you really cut the deficit enough? And so we're going to hear a lot of chest beating about how much more the Republicans are going to cut the deficit and how they're not going to raise taxes. And the Democrats have got their own talking points. But frankly, until we see the outcome of the election and both parties are forced into making a deal and compromising on these big issues, this is all election year posturing.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a Newsweek DailyBeast.com contributor. Her books include Selecting a President, new from Thomas Dunn Books, and War Without Bloodshed, The Art of Politics from Simon & Schuster.
Quote from the news, why don't you touch it and see for yourself? Touch it, dude. That was President Obama as he bent over to let the 5-year-old son of a departing black staff member see if their hair felt the same. The inspiring moment was caught in a photograph that's remained hanging in the West Wing for the last 3 years.
Next, NATO, Afghanistan, and the Snake Eaters. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It is like honey to my heart. For the first time in my life, I feel like I have a role to play. That was Cairo accountant Mohammed Mustafa Saif on voting in the nation's first free presidential election, albeit with an extreme Islamist and a confidant of ousted President Mubarak in the lead and the army still short of fully surrendering control. Now this.
This sends strong and clear signal to the people of Afghanistan, to the neighbors of Afghanistan, and indeed to the enemies of Afghanistan. Peace and stability in Afghanistan is a global imperative and a global commitment.
I'm Jacob Crawford. I went to Iraq and Afghanistan, and when they gave me these medals, I knew they were meaningless. I only regret not starting to speak up about how silly the war is sooner.
As NATO leaders in Chicago last week reached the consensus on Afghanistan announced by Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, disillusioned veterans of the wars there and in Iraq dumped the medals they received in protest. And even supporters of the NATO policy, withdrawal of major combat units, continuing financial and military support for another decade, conceded it was something of a gamble.
To consider that policy and the prospects in Afghanistan for your ears only, we're joined by Owen West, a former Marine Corps Reserve major who served two tours in Iraq and sees the need for more attention to lessons learned there about success against insurgency. His new book is The Snake Eaters, an unlikely band of brothers and the battle for the soul of Iraq from the Free Press. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
We should say at the start, your memoir of the Iraq War falls within a family tradition. Now, tell us about your father's famous account of the Vietnam War.
Well, my dad served for many years in Vietnam as a Marine, but he wrote an account of a small team of Marine advisors sent into a Vietnamese village to pacify it. Interestingly enough, I did a book report on that. That book was called The Village when I was in the fourth grade and received my lowest grade in elementary school on it. So I remember my dad pulling me aside afterwards and saying, you know, people just aren't ready for a success story in Vietnam. That was about 1978 or so.
Describe the Marine reservists in your crew of advisors to an Iraqi battalion in Qalidiya, Iraq, and the situation you found there.
The really interesting thing is that advisors have now become the centerpiece of U.S. military strategy in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. President Obama has basically adopted the same exit template. But no one seems to know what it is, you know, we advisors are supposed to do. That includes the American people, obviously, but also politicians. The president has several times referred to them as trainers and saying, differentiating the advisors from a combat mission, when actually the opposite is true. I mean, the advisor's very first job is to set the example in combat and to fight. So I think, you know, relative to Afghanistan, people will be surprised as we begin to withdraw in 2013 and 14 that casualties in these small units may rise.
Well, none of your crew had serious combat experience, so what was the most important factor in the support you were providing?
It's interesting. You know, half of advising is interpersonal relations. It's like a big game of the television show Survivor in order to gain influence over the local soldiers. So you're right. In Iraq, because we had no advisor doctrine and no trained advisors because of what happened to us in Vietnam, we sent in reservists. I mean, the folks I write about in The Snake Eaters are a rock and roll guitarist, a postal worker, a DEA agent, everyday Americans who had to figure out, you know, how to gain influence over these very foreign soldiers.
You had problems with Iraqi insurgents hiding among civilians, even with the battalion to which you were attached. Do you have any suggestions for dealing with the mounting number of so-called green-on-blue attacks on NATO forces now by their supposed Afghan allies?
We really didn't have this problem in Iraq, which shows you that we were basically aligned with the military there. In Afghanistan, however, as you point out, upwards of 25% of our casualties in 2012 have come from local soldiers who were supposedly training. This suggests that there may be an underlying problem there, and to solve it, you need essentially internal affairs inside every battalion. But it's scary when the folks you're teaching may sneak up at night and kill you.
In a larger sense, what's your reaction to the new NATO policy and its prospects for both fighting and negotiating with the Taliban?
In every war, at the conclusion, there must be repatriation of, you know, enemy combatants. People will be freed from jail. You can negotiate with the enemy, etc. But I think in just listening to your clip, I haven't seen as wide a schism as we have right now in Afghanistan during 10 more years of these wars between the folks who are really on point fighting, and captains, lieutenants, sergeants, etc., and the folks who are leading the war effort, there is great frustration among the lower ranks as to the progress we're making and the long-term prospects.
Even Iraq is still subject to insurgent attacks. How much danger to the U.S. do you see if the Washington-NATO strategy is not a significant success, given al-Qaeda's spread far beyond Afghanistan and even Pakistan?
I think we're going to be okay in Iraq, and I think we're going to be actually okay in Afghanistan. In Iraq, the biggest factor is that there's a source of revenue, and that's oil. But I think basically the Shia have learned that if they cut the Sunnis out entirely, these car bombings, which is the negotiating tool of choice that the hardcore Sunnis use, will continue. But look, there's been low level of violence in many, many countries that do not threaten the United States. I believe in Colombia, when we were aiding the war against the FARC, the Supreme Court was bombed, but now that country is also stable. So I think we're okay in Iraq.
You've talked about the importance of advisors, but do you expect maybe fear that an even newer way of war fighting will put more emphasis on those remotely controlled drone attacks on suspected enemy leaders and bases, with many more civilian casualties than on-the-ground missions with U.S. advisors?
Yeah, that is yet to be determined. I mean, essentially, you're asking, what are the lessons learned from these two wars? I think the biggest lesson is that we cannot do this alone, that only local forces can pick out the insurgents among the population and put down their own insurrections. So instead of sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops and spending $1 trillion, as we have over the course of a decade, we really need to look hard at the advisor model, where we send in small teams but rely on local forces. As to drones, I mean, this is going to be part of warfare in perpetuity now, but I think it will allow us to prevent the Taliban from massing and taking Kabul, for instance.
Tell us, where did the name Snake Eaters come from?
On their shoulder patch, they had a picture of a serpent being carried off by a hawk. I mean, and all their call signs were birds, so it was very natural. And then when they heard that Snake Eaters was also a moniker for U.S. Special Forces in Vietnam, they were really excited.
Tell me a last question. No one thinks the United States should not have eliminated Osama bin Laden inside Pakistan or not use drones to take out other terrorist leaders there. But do you think President Obama is maybe wrong to withhold an apology for the accidental killing of Pakistani border troops just to help political leaders there save face and maybe get those trucks that have been blocked on the border moving again?
Politics is really, really tricky, and I'm not an expert. I can tell you that for the Pakistanis, the same as the Afghans and the Iraqis, oftentimes an apology is looked at as weakness. And believe it or not, many of the troops, the Iraqi troops, used to tell us, you know, never apologize for things you do. I mean, this is the first thing that you'll show weakness, and the game in our town of Khalidia was to basically demonstrate to the locals, not that we're going to try to win their hearts or build bridges or nation build, as you hear in the popular press, but that we were going to prevail in the end.
Owen West is a former Marine Corps Reserve Major who served two tours in Iraq. His new book is The Snake Eaters, An Unlikely Band of Brothers and the Battle for the Soul of Iraq, from the Free Press.
Quote from the news, you have a debt crisis, a banking crisis, and a political crisis. That was New York University economics professor Thomas Cooley on the re-intensifying euro crisis, with Germany continuing to oppose calls for new euro bonds that might promote growth along with Berlin's pressure for austerity.
Next, faith and philanthropy, the Nathan Cummings story for your ears only.
We're back with more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Even if we disagree on the shape, we think there is the beginning of a negotiation. That was a senior American official after Iran rejected a new proposal to halt uranium enrichment, blaming insufficient easing of international sanctions. Now this.
My grandfather, Nathan Cummings, was a very successful businessman. Even from the time he was a child, there was an ethic within his family of giving back to community that they felt like they were very blessed, and yet he came from very meager means, but even still there was this Jewish tradition of giving back to community.
Nathan Cummings Foundation board member Rick Cummings spoke about his grandfather, creator of the Sarah Lee Corporation, when the foundation was honored last summer by the Breakthrough Institute at an inaugural dialogue on the environment. But that's only one special interest of the NCF, along with social justice, the arts, culture, health, and Jewish life. And this year, the foundation has moved into an even higher gear under new president and CEO Simon Greer, a 20-year veteran of labor and community organizing and social change leadership.
With gratitude for a grant from Cummings, made, we should note, before Greer's arrival, we thought it fitting to talk about his views on the foundation's larger operations and goals, as well as the role of philanthropy generally at a time when government services and initiatives at so many levels are being cut back. And for your ears only, we're pleased to have Simon Greer on the line now. Welcome to our program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Rick Cummings talked about the Jewish ethic of giving back to the community, and you've spoken in the past about defining community and the Jewish role in it in the broadest possible sense. Talk about that and how it shapes your view of what your foundation should be doing in these times of tight budgets and growing disparities in wealth and power.
Sure. I mean, I think you can come at it from many different points of view, but however you slice this one, I think the Jewish tradition, both the lived experience of Jews in this country and coming to this country, as well as the biblical tradition, all point us in the direction of giving back and giving back generously. I've taken that interpretation, and many others have, and not just to mean giving back to the Jewish community, but giving to the larger community. And I think that also can be drawn both from text, if you will, and from experience. You know, I love reminding people that the phrase from the Bible, everyone was made in the image of God, predates their being Israelites. And so that belief in each person's sort of sacredness or holiness isn't a reference to them being Jews or Israelites. It actually is to every human that's made in the divine images. So I draw it from the sort of universal promise of phrases like that are throughout the Bible. But I also think sometimes when there's a narrow focus of Jewish community should help Jews, it's based out of, I think, sort of an old school experience or memory. I think it's probably true that when we lived in Poland, 100 years ago, there weren't a lot of people in looking out for the Jewish residents of the Warsaw Ghetto other than the Jews. And so, fair enough, Jews had to take it upon themselves to provide effective healthcare systems and sewer systems and make sure that those in need had something to eat. But that's a different world, quite frankly. In America today, we'll never solve the problems that affect Jews just by dealing with those problems as Jews.
Health is a major interest of the Cummings Foundation. I wonder how you decide on grants to foster progress in that area at a time when there's such contention over it, specifically the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, now before the Supreme Court.
We've long believed that healthcare has, there's three essential elements to a just healthcare system: affordable healthcare, quality healthcare, accessible healthcare. And we will always support any effort to make that possible. The really precarious moment here is that if the Affordable Care Act is struck down, if people give up on this kind of reform, it will be generations before we see meaningful reform again. And of course, this is really just the beginning. I mean, this is only a piece of legislation that opens the door to the possibility that we could take responsibility for everyone's health care in this country. And I think long before I was at the foundation, they were committed to that. And I believe we will continue to be committed through the Supreme Court decision. And then come what may, our grant-making strategy may adjust. We may have to go more state level and look for reform there. But we will continue to be committed until, every last person in this country can get the health care they need at the quality they need and the affordability that they can manage.
We mentioned last year's breakthrough dialogue on the environment, bringing together experts with differing points of view. Is that a key operating principle for you?
In the opening quote from one of our trustees, from Rick Cummings, he talked about Nathan Cummings being a successful businessman, and that's completely true. What I've come to learn about the foundation is a lot of Nathan Cummings' approach to business is now embodied in the foundation. And I think Nathan Cummings believed in doing things that might be unorthodox, or seeing a possibility where others saw none, or taking a risk where they thought the risk was too high. And I think out of that spirit has come this belief that if you simply go down one road, support one approach to whatever the problem is, and you just keep doing it again and again and again, I think history has shown that that doesn't usually give us the kind of breakthrough solutions that we need. It's by creating a little tension between divergent opinions, different ideas, that you're often able to provoke that new or insightful view or vantage point that ends up taking you down the actual road to a transformative solution, one that's sustainable over time.
What are some of the other Cummings-funded projects and programs in other areas about which you're most excited?
I think what I've come to really admire about the foundation, and a lot of this is the wisdom of the folks who have been leading at the staff and board level since before I was there, is that the foundation tends to not just make kind of one-off grants, oh, this is a great group, fund them, this is a great group, fund them, but see a whole system, a sector or an ecosystem. So the sector that I come out of most recently is the what was supported through Jewish Life and Values, where the foundation staff have over more than a decade built a whole slew of organizations from Bend the Arc to American Jewish World Service to Join for Justice, that by funding all these different groups, you start to create where there was nothing, where there was sort of a void before. There were not many groups that were Jewishly motivated and committed to social justice in the everyday work that they do. There's now a whole sector of them. And for basically any Jew in America, if you're interested in social change, you can participate through one of these organizations, whether you're in high school, college, you're retired, you're religious, you're secular, you care about immigration or you care about education. And I think the vantage point the foundation has taken, that we fund whole sectors, we don't just bet on one organization, is really probably what will sustain the sort of the legacy of the foundation's funding strategy for a long time.
Simon Greer is the new president and CEO of the Nathan Cummings Foundation, a funder, as we've noted, of this program.
Quote from the news, "It's about this trust. This is another stock market rigging." That was Elias Fiani, a New York City Transit Authority employee, on not getting the same warnings that giant investors did about the controversial Facebook IPO, which quickly failed to hold its opening price and is now under investigation.
Next, fallout from a resignation at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the lessons learned from Fukushima. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "He was remorseful, and I think the detectives thought that it was a feeling of relief on his part." That was New York City Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly on the confession of former Soho area bodega worker Pedro Hernandez in New Jersey that he fatally choked 6-year-old Eitan Pates in 1979 and disposed of the body in a bag with local trash. The murder raised the nation's level of attention to child kidnapping, but there may be no solid evidence to support the Hernandez confession. Now this.
"The task force calls on the commission to redefine adequate protection in light of what we've learned from Fukushima."
I have indicated to Mr. Daley in that letter that I was sorry for the distraction that this has caused.
Last summer, the chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Gregory Yatsko, was all about defending Americans from a nuclear accident like that which followed the giant earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan. By the end of the year, Yatsko was defending himself from allegations by fellow commissioners and staffers that his leadership style was abusive and high-handed. And last week he announced his resignation, with the Obama administration quickly announcing it would nominate environmental science professor Allison McFarlane, a nuclear waste expert, to replace him.
As Yatsko gave up his position, Japan was giving up nuclear power altogether, joining a number of countries now opting for safer renewable energy. At the same time, a preliminary estimate from the World Health Organization found the accident of Fukushima did not increase the risk of cancer, except for some infants in a nearby town exposed to radioactive iodine. Other experts are calling that a comforting delusion. For one view of the NRC shakeup and the lessons learned from Fukushima, or not. For your ears only, we're joined again by prize-winning investigative reporter, journalism professor, author, and nuclear critic Carl Grossman. Welcome back to the program.
A pleasure, David.
First, let's talk about Yatsko's resignation. During his tenure, he pushed to address safety problems at nuclear plants and got pushback from other commissioners of both parties. What was their rationale?
Well, this is not an anti-nuclear fellow. This is a guy with a PhD in physics. As Christopher Payne of the Natural Resources Defense Council said, Greg's not anti-nuclear, but he's pro-nuclear in a smart and considered way. What the nuclear industry wants are people who are not particularly smart and considered in terms of nuclear technology. They want puppets. Yatsko was not a puppet, and he ended up being pushed out as chairman of the NRC.
What do we know about the style and standards of Professor McFarlane, who's going to be nominated to replace him?
Well, the issue with the NRC sort of goes beyond individuals, unfortunately. I mean, she's an associate professor, and she's been very interested in nuclear waste. But you have to go back and look at the culture of the NRC. We used to have the Atomic Energy Commission, was disbanded in 1974 because it had conflicting missions to both promote and regulate nuclear technology, nuclear power. It was replaced by the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and later, given the promotional role, ostensibly, for nuclear power, was the Department of Energy. The Atomic Energy Commission and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, throughout all the decades, both never denied a construction or operating license for any nuclear power plant anywhere, anytime in the U.S. It really should be called the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission, NR for Rubber Stamp Commission. It's just a lapdog for the nuclear industry, and anyone who doesn't fall in line, like JASCO, ends up being pushed out.
What changes in nuclear regulation or operation actually were adopted in the U.S. after Fukushima, and what are the most important lessons that have not been implemented?
In fact, we've been going backwards. Other countries have been going forward. Germany, for example, because of Fukushima, has decided to shut down all its 23 nuclear power plants and develop safe, clean, renewable energy technologies, solar and wind and so forth. We have gone absolutely the other way. For example, on June 7th, we're just talking about in a few days, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is sponsoring a conference to discuss its consideration of allowing nuclear power plants in the U.S. to go for 80 years. Originally, they were only conceived for 40 years because after 40 years, metals become so embrittled, you have a safety issue. In recent years, nevertheless, the NRC has allowed more than half the nuclear, 104 nuclear plants in the U.S., the NRC, and this has been going on since Fukushima as well, has allowed 73 nuclear plants to keep operating for 60 years. As I note, in just a few days, it's going to have this conference on letting them go 80 years. Imagine having an 80-year-old car and taking it on the interstate highway or any highway. How confident would you be in the reliability of that automobile? The NRC, the Department of Energy, the Obama administration overall, because it's been pushing this is post-Fukushima, the licensing of new nuclear power plants has been going backwards. I mean, this was one of the big problems with the nuclear industry and the nuclear establishment in government and JASCO. For example, this is back in February, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in a 4-1 vote, gave the go-ahead for two new nuclear plants to be built down in Georgia, the Vogtle nuclear plants. And JASCO said, "I cannot support issuing this license as if Fukushima has never happened." And he called for lessons learned about Fukushima to be adopted in terms of the NRC's position on licensing. They have not. The NRC has been going backwards. They are of the opinion that Fukushima is not the catastrophe that it is, and we just have to keep promoting, pushing nuclear power.
Carl Grossman is a prize-winning investigative reporter, a journalism professor at the State University of New York, and the author of many books, including Cover Up, What You Are Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. Follow him at carlgrossman.com.
Quote from the news, "I have disenchanted both sides." That was New Jersey Judge Glenn Berman after both prosecution and defense vowed to appeal his controversial sentence of only 30 days in jail for Rutgers student Dahrun Ravi, whose webcam spying on a gay roommate led to his suicide.
Next, Singing the 60s for your ears only.
A final verse for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelworth with a quote from the news. It's almost as important as sex. That was comment on the TV remote control by Eugene Pauly, who invented it and died last week at the age of 96. Now this.
If you are feeling fancy free, come wander through the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous.
Jennifer Sheehan singing Two for the Road by Henry Mancini and Leslie Bercus from the movie of the same name, and typical of tunes that elevated even non-musical films in the 1960s. And Hollywood was only one source for the music that so marked that decade. The others including Motown, Liverpool, the songwriters of L.A.'s Laurel Canyon, and the legendary Hit Factory in New York's Brill Building.
If you can fully remember the music of the 60s, or anything about it, the joke goes, you really weren't there. So Sheehan is singing some of the era's most memorable numbers in a new show at Feinstein's Cabaret in Manhattan's Loews Regency Hotel through June 2nd. It's called I Know a Place, after the 1965 Petula Clark hit. And to talk about it, for your ears only, we're pleased to have Jennifer Sheehan on our show again. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be on.
Oh, so your new show starts with an old-timey radio announcer voice introduction that you didn't have to go very far for.
Yes, that's right. We have a really fun little radio introduction, kind of like an old-time radio commercial for a station. And my dad actually provides the voiceover for that. He was a DJ in the late 60s at a big Chicago radio station. So he has that fun, you know, old-time announcer voice, and we splice in all kinds of great clips of old 60s songs into his little patter, and it's just a really fun way to get the show moving.
You're best known for celebrating earlier entries in the American songbook, the classics of Kern and Cole Porter, Gershwin, Berlin, Rodgers and Hart. Even the 60s must be ancient history for you. You're so young. Or was that music still playing in your house as a kid?
It was. You know, I had all kinds of music playing in my house growing up, actually. But certainly, both of my parents would play a lot of, you know, the music of their generation around our house. So that was, you know, a big part of my influence. I remember we had a Bacharach and David songbook on our piano, and I would try to learn tunes from that. And, you know, today it's really kind of amazing. I cannot go anywhere without hearing 60s music on the radio. You know, if I'm at a cafe, I was even at a little cafe this afternoon, and, you know, The Beat Goes On was playing, and a Dusty Springfield song came on right after that. It wasn't even an oldie station as far as I knew, but 60s music is playing in everywhere, clothing stores and restaurants, and I just can't seem to get away from it.
I was struck by some of the connections you discovered between the era's various musical genres. You talk about the way Portugal's bossa nova influenced America's Burt Bacharach.
Yes, right. Well, you know, I think, you know, one thing that I find so fascinating and wonderful and kind of distinct about the 60s is that, you know, as you had this new technology and travel kind of shrinking the world, you know, composers were being influenced by all kinds of music from around the world. So exactly, you know, Brazilian music and bossa nova. I read that Bacharach liked to visit all of the clubs playing, you know, bebop and jazz in New York City, and he was especially taken by the rhythms of bossa nova, which, you know, as you can tell in many of his songs, kind of have that Latin bossa nova influence in them.
And the Beatles were not shy about the inspiration they took from the older American songbook. In fact, Paul McCartney has just issued a CD of those standards called Kisses on the Bottom, but not with very racy roots.
Right, exactly. It's a beautiful album. And yes, in fact, yeah, Paul McCartney's dad led a dance band in the 20s, and he taught his sons American standards. So they've actually, the Beatles have cited that as their earliest influence, actually.
And talk about the singer-songwriters of the 60s whose creations were so personal, it must take some bravery for anyone else to perform them. Carole King, Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell.
Right, sure. No, yeah, that's exactly right. We do a Carole King song and Paul Simon. We do Old Friends, Bookends, Simon and Garfunkel. You know, I certainly turned to them for the inspiration, and, you know, they wrote the music. It came from their heart, but... You know, everyone has their own
their own take on it, their own something to say about it. And so I tried to bring my own personal experience to each of those songs, too.
You were struck by the emotional reaction those 50-year-old songs still generate in the comment sections that you saw on YouTube.
Right. Well, you know, that's actually been quite a part of my research and in a way my reintroduction to the music of the 60s. I make the point in my show actually that we are very lucky right now to have websites like YouTube. You know, yes, you can watch silly cat videos and whatever else, but you can also find some really amazing videos of 1960s TV variety shows and live concerts and backstage interviews that have never been seen before. And, you know, that's pretty special. And what's great to read is, you know, the comments underneath. You see comments from, you know, older people who maybe lived through that time and their perspective on the music now. And especially, and I'll tell you, this is really what you see more than anything else, young people writing, "Oh my gosh, I wish we had this music. I love this music. Why can't my generation have music like this?" And it really is the prevailing comment in all of the posts that you see. So it's definitely timeless, and it really strikes a chord no matter what age you are.
Jennifer Sheehan sings Songs of the 60s at Feinstein's Cabaret in New York's Loews Regency Hotel through June 2nd. Check out jennifersheehan.com.
As long as love still wears a smile, I know that we'll be two for the road. And that's a long, long ride.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please email me at davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at the Hangar Studio with interns Daniela Quintanilla and Kaimana Larson. I'm Melissa Exelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from Gatewave.org, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com.
For a Memorial Day weekend last year, we got the increasingly less unusual view of a female warrior back from Iraq from our May 29, 2011 broadcast hosted by Melissa and David.
The Sadr movement is ready to take any necessary action. In the event that the troops refuse to leave, be it positive or negative, such as mass strikes, demonstrations, and military action.
Sounds of the shock and awe attack that preceded the U.S. ground war in Iraq in March of 2003 and threats this month by opposition leader Muqtada al-Sadr of new violence if any U.S. forces remain at the request of the Baghdad government after their promised withdrawal. Indeed, two American soldiers were among 20 people killed in recent rocket attacks in the capital, part of a resurgent tide of ethnic violence. And last week, the official in charge of purging Iraqi institutions of those linked to the regime of Saddam Hussein was shot dead driving home in Baghdad.
On this Memorial Day weekend, we look back at the Iraq War and ahead to continuing conflict in the area from the special viewpoint of Marine Reserve Major Jane Blair, who fought there. Her new memoir of it is Hesitation Kills, A Female Marine Officer's Experience in Iraq, from Rauman and Littlefield Publishers. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, Melissa and David. I appreciate it.
You weren't an officer to begin with. Tell us what led you to join the Marines and how you rose to the rank of lieutenant by the time of the Iraq War.
Well, you know, I started off from a very different background. I didn't have any family members in the military. I grew up in Miami Beach in New York, and so when I looked into going into the military, I started asking a bunch of Marines, you know, what was the best avenue to join. And everyone I talked to said, if you want to be a real Marine, you should go enlisted first, because then you're going to know exactly what it's like. And so that's what I did. I started off, and, you know, it was a very humbling experience for me, actually, because I thought I would be doing cool things like, you know, storming beachfronts, and instead I was learning to swab the deck and scrub the toilets. But, you know, all in all, frankly, it really made me into a better officer when I finally became an officer, because I really learned what it was like to treat Marines the right way.
What was your assignment in Iraq, and how dangerous was it?
I was the collections officer at an unmanned aerial vehicle unit, and we basically went ahead of frontline troops because we were an aerial reconnaissance unit. And, you know, frankly, it was extremely dangerous. I mean, there were constant threats. You never knew what was going to go ahead of you. Especially during the initial ground assault, we had no idea what to expect, whether gas attacks or whether, you know, Scud attacks. We were pretty much left to any kind of threat ahead of us.
You also faced special challenges from male officers, doubts about your ability, and bullying because of your gender, though bullying seems fairly common in the Corps.
Reflecting back on it now, I think as a second lieutenant, there's a certain amount of rites of passage that you go through as a junior officer. Similar to maybe the police force or other professions like that. And so as a young officer, I think, you know, it's kind of natural to go through that. And until you find your place and learn how to be a leader. And as a female, you know, I learned I really had to become a Marine first, a Marine leader first, and not make any excuses. And once I started falling into sort of the behavior of what was expected for me as a leader, I think it became much easier, and the female issue no longer seemed to be relevant.
What differences did you observe about the way male and female Marines dealt with fear, death, and the challenges of leadership, and how did you deal with them?
Seeing both men and women in a combat situation, I really didn't see a lot of difference. You know, people bottle up, I think, that fear a lot is what I saw on the battlefield, is really people internalizing the fears that they felt. And for the most part, the Marines were really courageous. It was amazing to see such young people out there and, you know, sacrificing and not making excuses and just willing to fight even, you know, at their death. So very courageous. For me, you know, internally it was very hard to come to terms with the fact that you could die at any moment. And I had to really grapple with that at the beginning mentally. But I think once you get enough adrenaline in you, you kind of just have to charge on with the mission. And it doesn't, you lose that fear a little bit because the adrenaline's so high and you're just going off and you kind of forget, you lose your perspective of where you are.
Where do you stand on an amendment to the 2012 Defense Authorization Bill that would lift all remaining limits to women serving in combat, in part to equalize chances for promotion?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting issue that has surfaced as of late. I'm not a policymaker. And I think it's really a question for Congress to answer and to decide whether they are ready or if they want to make this change at all. We are a civilian-led military force for a reason. And, you know, as a member of military, I defer to when Congress, if they ever think it's right for females to enter that role. But certainly, I think if people want to get insight into what combat is like and from a woman's perspective, they should read my book, Hesitation Kills, and really draw their own conclusions.
Like many U.S. service personnel, you missed your spouse, but you also had special opportunities to see him from time to time, thanks to the Corps.
That's correct, yes. I was very lucky. I remember during a two-week period when all the units were retrograding and they all combined into one central area, I had an opportunity to see my husband by chance.
He is also a Marine and now a Marine Reserve officer.
That's correct.
Since your service in Iraq, you've become a student of Arabic and won a master's degree in strategic studies. From that perspective, what changes would you have made to the U.S. strategy and tactics in Iraq?
You know, that's a great question, because I think it's so important, having seen the difference from understanding a culture's language to not, and how my view of the culture has changed. I think it's so necessary for our troops, the military, to study the culture before they go there and to come up with specialized training throughout the world of different cultures. You know, we live in a globalized society now. It's impossible for us not to have relations really with all countries throughout the world. I think that it would have impacted the way that we fought in Iraq had we engaged it from a more educated perspective, understanding the Arab culture more, the tribal systems, and the language for sure.
Well, given the resurgence of ethnic violence, do you think that anything short of another brutal strongman like Saddam Hussein can keep all of those rivalries in check?
I think that we are experiencing a great change now in the Middle East, where many different Arab nations are seeing that a strongman in place is really not the answer anywhere, and people are kind of taking social responsibility for their own countries, even in Iraq. I think it's phenomenal that that people throughout the Middle East are realizing that there's a role for them in politics and in society beyond the usual. It's not just up to one leader to decide people's fate.
Marine Reserve Major Jane Blair is the author of Hesitation Kills, A Female Marine Officer's Experience in Iraq, from Rauman and Littlefield Publishers.
Iraq Remembered, from our May 29, 2011 broadcast. On the military's gender front, U.S. Marine Corps General James Amos last month ordered the admission of female Marines to the infantry school at Quantico, Virginia, as well as some ground combat battalions for the first time. In Iraq, however, many of the sectarian issues from early days of the U.S. invasion still fester, notably division over the division of profitable oil exports between Baghdad and the country's Kurdish north. In Waco, Texas last week, Army PFC Nasser Jason Abdo, on trial for planning to bomb Fort Hood troops at a local restaurant and shoot the survivors, was heard in a recording telling his mother it's all true, motivated by his desire to avenge wrongful treatment of fellow Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan. The reason is religion. There is no other reason, said Abdo, who faces life in prison if convicted. I'm Daniela Quintanilla. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, another song from the 60s by Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees, dead last week of cancer at age 62.
I started a joke which started the whole world crying, but I didn't say, oh no, that the joke was on me, oh no. I started to cry, which started the whole world laughing. Oh, if I only seen that the joke was on me. I looked at the sky, running my hands over my eyes, and I fell out of bed, hurting my head from things that I'd said, till I finally died, which started the whole world laughing. Oh, if I only seen that the joke was of me. From things that I'd said, till I finally died, which started the whole world living. Oh, would I only see that the joke was on me? Oh, no, that the joke was on me.